Welcome to the Bridgetown podcast. I'm sitting here, John Mark Comer, with the one and only, the legendary Mark Sayers. Nice. I feel like if we were like more high tech, we'd have music in the background right now, an orchestra or something. Mark Sayers here all the way from, we would call it Melbourne, which is because we're American, but I believe it's actually Melbourne, Australia. Is that how you say it? I'm not even going to try. So welcome. Really happy to have you here. And Mark is in town and passing through. We're actually both going to an event tomorrow morning in California. And then I think you're on the docket for Q next week. So really great to have you on the West Coast of America. And Mark passing through, we said, hey, let's sit down and have a conversation. Mark, if you are not familiar with his work, is, and I say this not to butter you up, but in my humble opinion, you are one of the most important living teachers in the world. And your influence on me as a teacher and on Bridgetown Church is incalculable. The way that you have helped us to make sense of our cultural moment. I think when I started out as a teacher, I was basically just teaching the Bible and the way of Jesus. And then now I kind of think about it almost through a Venn diagram. In one quadrant, I'm teaching the Bible. And then in another, I'm teaching like the way of Jesus, spiritual formation, because we don't just teach for information, but as you know, we teach for transformation. So now I'm really interested in this idea of practice and community and the role of the Holy Spirit, how we move from a 40-minute TED Talk about Jesus to transformation. But I think in the last couple of years, you in particular have added almost a third circle to the Venn diagram, and that is this idea of cultural commentary. And so Mark, if you're not familiar with his work, is a local church pastor in, however you say it, Australia. You lead a church, Red Church in Blackburn, Australia, which is right in urban Melbourne.
Melbourne on the east side.
Yep, on the east side. And I'm really looking forward to getting to visit your church hopefully this fall. But so you are a local church pastor and a Bible teacher, and you're fantastic at both. But what you're really known for is cultural commentary. That's kind of what you're famous for. And so Mark's the author of a number of books. I've read all of them. They are all fantastic. My favorite is Disappearing Church. That's kind of like in my top three must reads. Whenever people say, what book should I read? It's always in the top three right there. It's like you, Dallas Willard, and N.T. Wright. So you are in good company, you know. But I wanted to chat today around your most recent book. So it's called Strange Days, Life in the Spirit in an Age of Upheaval.
Yes.
Right? You changed the title. I got to read an advanced copy, and it was absolutely fantastic. And it's out. Is it out now? Or
I haven't checked. Or it's just officially May 2nd.
May 2nd, So just so go on Amazon now, pre-order. It's well. Mark's a great writer. All of his books are pretty short, easy to get through. And this book is especially helpful. Tell us a little bit about the genesis of it. It was a last-minute thing, right, with your publisher, and you had surgery, I know, in your vocal cords, and it wasn't, you were not planning on writing this.
No. Well, I wrote Disappearing Church really about how does the church be the church in an age which seemed to be undergoing, being drenched by a progressive cultural wave.
Right, the whole post-Christian moment.
Totally. And so I finished that and just began to notice, probably as the book was being released, just sensing something in the subterranean atmosphere. And then these little things that popped up, Brexit, and then the campaign here, across the world, though. Like, this is a global thing that's happening. And just little conversations and moments I had with people that there was this moment of upheaval coming. And a lot of what we thought about the narrative of where everything was going to go, that the progressive West, which seemed to be in power, all of a sudden started to feel like fragile. And then just this, what a lot of people think is a conservative or right-wing backlash, but I don't think it is, thing happened. Trump's election, I remember people saying to me, you know, what do you think is going to happen in Trump's election? I was like, my head says he won't win. My heart's saying something weird is happening. And so I saw this reaction, you know, in you know, even in like the way ISIS seemed to be increasing their attacks. You know, I think of the attacks in the Bataclan in Paris, all that was going on, studying what was happening in Russia and Russia's growing influence in the world. And so I just thought, I've got to write the next chapter. I wanted to have like 2 years off, have a little break.
Yeah.
And then I'm like,
because you'd just done that one book.
Totally, yeah. And written 6 books pretty much all in a row and was tired. And and then I had this like throat operation, and I said to my publishers, hey, let's write this really short book. And they're like, yeah, let's do
it. Because you like could not teach for a month or
couldn't
something.
Couldn't speak,
right?
So I had to have voice rest. And then belted this book out, and glad I did. Yeah.
So I want you to just give us the summary. I just, before this, came from lunch with our three guests in from the UK who were here leading our Holy Spirit conference over the weekend. And it's interesting. They got in, I think, Wednesday night. I picked them up from the airport, and they've been up for, I think, 26 hours or something. And they came over to my house for dinner, and all they wanted to talk about was Donald Trump and America and has the world gone mad. And then we just had kind of our final lunch. We have gatherings tonight, but it was our last kind of time around a table. And it was back to that again. And I think the sense for followers of Jesus from England is just, you know, what's going on in your country? Has your country gone mad? And I'd love you to speak into that, because it's not just an American thing. Totally. Wherever you're at on the political spectrum, most people would agree that whatever is happening right now is not healthy, and something is really belly up right now in the political system. But of course, that's symbolic of a much larger socioeconomic and even racial movement across America. But it's not really just an American thing. You're seeing this all over the world. So just would you, in a moment, name our cultural moment at a national and an international level as you see it?
Yeah, so I would say what's actually happening is we're entering a new stage of globalization, which is putting incredible pressures on the ways in which we understand the world. And I mean, we can talk a bit more about, I think there's a religious architecture underneath that, and that's what I'm interested in. But, you know, the UK has elected Labour Party Jeremy Corbyn, the most furthest left Labour Party member, to be leader, who will not win, get destroyed, but that's a sign. Yeah. Poland to the far right, Hungary to the far right, Spain far left, Greek far left, Iceland the pirate party coming to power. You know, this is a global thing. And even
today
in the two
France.
So today in France, the final runoff will be between Le Pen and Macron, which is like Obama versus Trump, sort of, you know, and to put the equivalence. But this is happening in Burma. This is happening in South Africa. This is happening in you've got the rise of anti-Muslim nationalist Buddhist figures,
right?
Hindu figures. So I think I've been interested in taking a real macro view, and maybe being in Australia at the bottom of the world, you get to see this bigger picture. So there's this pressure between the new axis. So the Slovenian philosopher Žižek says that it's no longer between left and right, it's between these two visions of globalism and nationalism.
And more and more people are saying that.
Yeah, so I think that's the ultimate.
So you're saying the rise that we see in America and around the world of the hard right and the hard left, for lack of better language, is really less about the political ideology and more about globalization versus nationalism.
Yes. So it's interesting talking to people here where they go, oh, the racial issue, which is definitely an issue. But then you see something like fascinating in South Africa, where you've got the people who went through apartheid population now having this whole issue with immigrants.
Right.
So it's this sense where different racial populations in different countries are, it's like we're going back to identity, whether it's religion, race, even politics. You know, communism is having a comeback around the world. It's bizarre. So like these old markers of the past that we thought had passed have all of a sudden sort of risen from the grave.
And specifically sparked by globalization,
yes,
the kind of move to a borderless society.
And partly what it is too is, so part of, one of the stories that I tell in the book is the story that in 1989, when the Berlin Wall fell, and I use in the book the example of David Hasselhoff, who he basically had done Knight Rider in America.
And his career, grew up on Knight Rider.
Oh, it was the
not
best.
Not to date myself, but I grew up on it.
Oh, it was like the original driverless car. And his career went under after that, didn't get a gig, and then does this album. And it's like this, you know, sappy pop, you know, ballad album. And dies in America. But in the German-speaking countries, he gets picked up because he's got German heritage and stuff like that. And he goes number one across the German-speaking world. But his song, Are You Looking for Freedom, is like, it's exactly at this moment when communism is starting to crack. And so the battle between communism and capitalism had really defined the 20th century. And there was a whole bunch of thinking in Marxism that history is created by the battle between capitalism and then the sort of proletariat who wanted, you know, sort of the utopian people's paradise. And so we thought that would just go on. The CIA, when the Berlin Wall fell, thought it was a ruse by the Russians. So you get this bizarre moment. The wall falls on November 9th, and then at the New Year celebration, they invite David Hasselhoff to sing Are You Looking for Freedom? He wears this shirt. It's on YouTube. You should check it out.
This like, is pre-Baywatch, right?
Pre-Baywatch.
Yeah.
Yeah, he hadn't had his second moment. So you've got this shirt where it's like flashing. He's got these lights in it because he wanted to be seen. And there's a bit where this firework just misses his like, you know, hairsprayed mullet.
Giant hair.
And but it's this sort of moment where people are going crazy. And then it's like history's changed. And so this thesis emerges, pushed by a guy called Francis Fukuyama, who's an American political scientist, that history had now ended. The battle between capitalism and communism was over. Capitalism wins. Liberal democracy wins. This is the future. There's not going to be more conflicts anymore. It's a unipolar world with America at the top, and everyone will slowly, through globalization, everyone's going to get a fax machine and a mobile phone.
And everybody will come around to seeing the world the way that we see the world in the West, right? That was kind of the assumption. I think it still is the assumption. Get the right education, get the right government, everybody will start to agree with us once they're enlightened.
Absolutely. And what's really interesting is that the internet hits not too long after this, and you've got the cyber utopian thing, which particularly from this part of the world, like, is a combination of technological optimism and hippie communality at the same time. So it's not that, it's not like we've jumped ahead and we've got, the Jetsons future. It's like what's grown is the cyber world, you know. So that's
hyperconnectivity,
which actually reflects an ideology. So that all happens at the same time. It's the rise of consumerism, which is pushed by Madison Avenue. So it's like all the big dreams get pushed down with this end of history idea. And what happens is politics comes to the middle. Bill Clinton runs very successfully as a Democrat, but with Republican economic policies. Tony Blair, Labour politician, left-wing in Britain, but he's like cool, has Oasis over for cups of tea, but has right-wing, you know, politics. So it's like that old thing's gone. And so everyone just thought that the future's going to go towards that. And we ignored some things like the falling apart of Yugoslavia, but there was an international coalition which knocked that out. So it's like, this is the story which is now going to define us. So the whole mentality of cities like yours and mine, where it's sort of gentrified, inner city, progressive.
Kind of this march to the godless secular utopia.
Totally. That will just continue.
Yep.
We can have everything we want now. We can got easy, cheap international travel. We can jump on a discount flight. We can get a mobile phone. That's fantastic. And so what I think's actually happened, the reason, like your friends were asking, has the world gone mad? It's not that the world's gone mad. The world always was mad. The world was mad underneath this. In the middle of that period, the Great War of Africa occurred, which some people estimate killed 3 million people. We don't think about it because it's off the radar. So the world's always been sinful. The world's always been broken in chaos. War has always been the norm. It's just that we bought a myth. Alan Greenspan talked about during that period, the period of unending economic growth.
Right.
So you have then these shocks. I think there's these shocks and they get quicker. So they're like September 11th.
Yeah.
Popped the
rude
bubble.
Wake-up call. Not Massive. Everybody wants what we want.
Exactly. And then all of a sudden, that's when the Islamic thing begins. So the Islamic thing is, or the particularly, what's interesting is that globalization has two sides. So it has the side where you've got all of this stuff we've been talking about going, but then you've got people passing tapes of Wahhabist, Salafist preachers from Saudi Arabia into Indonesia, into Algeria, into Afghanistan. You've got this globalization of this radical Islam at the same time happening. So in some ways, September 11th was an attack against this sort of form of globalization story that hit the World Trade Center. It's a really interesting target
really
to choose.
Really symbolic target.
And then you got sort of like even the Asian tsunami was a shock in that it was Mother Nature's like power and on video. So we got to see it. The global financial crisis. But then the shock's getting quicker. The rise of ISIS when something worse that actually so bad Al-Qaeda turns on them. You know,
the breakdown of Iraq.
Breakdown of Iraq. Syria, the Arab Spring, which almost began sort of as like, oh, this is the example of Obama's foreign policy. We're going to have this Twitter-led, you know, amazing uprising, which completely confirms to our narrative that, everything's going to get better. Just give people Twitter accounts and everything will be fine.
Yeah.
And then it turns to hell and, like, just a bloodbath. And you've then got Russia, you know, invasion of Ukraine, absolutely shocks people. And then all of a sudden, everyone's like, what is going on?
It's like, I thought we moved on from this.
Totally.
Yeah, I thought this was in the past.
Absolutely. And then the migrant crisis. And so it's just been these cascading shocks, which then I think has then influenced the political landscape. So what I think this is it's actually all the contradictions and mistakes of the mythology that we held falling apart. So it's not the world's falling apart. Our false view of the world's falling apart.
Yeah. So speak to those, the subterranean architecture, as you would say, those mythologies. What are the mythologies of the Western world that are leading to this moment where we're all just upside down right now?
Yes. So Fukuyama, who posited this idea of the end of history, ultimately built his theory upon a French philosopher called Alexandre Kojève, who's French-Russian. And he wrote in the 1950s and led these lectures in the 40s and 50s with all these really influential thinkers, some on the right, like Leo Strauss, who had actually come to influence some of the sort of alt-right new thinking. Mm-hmm. And then you've got people like Foucault and a lot of the French postmodernists. And his argument was that we would get to the end of history, but we would become bored. And our desire for meaning would then mean that we, at the end of history, you turn into an animal because there's nothing left to struggle. We would become like bees. So we're just like little worker bees. And in many ways, it's become like that. Like we're constantly on our phones. We're working longer hours in many places.
Right.
And you've got overemployment and then people who are underemployed and have too much pleasure. So his idea was that if that happened, we would lose an essential part of our humanity, that to be truly human is to struggle, to fight. And so I think that the architecture of this is that people want to fight for something. This is why the main proponents of ISIS's attacks in the West are young men who are actually Western, second and third generation, sometimes Muslim guys, who look at the West and go, I hate this, and turn on it. This is why you've got in left-wing politics increasingly going further to the left, where instead of just going, we want to deal with racism and we don't deal with sexism, the new thought of intersectionality, which sees that...
Oh, and the move straight from gay marriage victory to, or if you want to call it that, to right to the transgender conversation.
Yes, so it's like this thing of like not seeing that maybe that was won on this sort of argument where a lot of people were like, I don't necessarily agree with that, but I don't have the energy to fight against it. But seeing that as we can now take the commanding heights of culture.
Right.
And Yuval Levin says this really interesting thing in his book, The Fractured Republic, that the new left or this new left find themselves in the position that the religious right were in the 80s. They're now on the battlements preaching downwards.
Exactly.
And people don't like being preached to by the religious
right.
Using
guilt and shame.
Totally, totally. And using accusatory language.
And bigotry.
Totally,
like, one of the fascinating things to me to watch in this last election cycle was a lot of the racism on the right, but the full-on bigotry from the left. You know,
yes.
Full-on. You're stupid, like just because you disagree with me. You know?
Yes. And it's interesting. So, I mean, I can come back to that about some of that. I want to finish the – I should finish what I'm saying about the right as well. But so you've got that – they then see the world as this massive, completely bigoted system of male patriarchy, white rule, heteronormative rule, and it becomes this very dark picture of the whole of culture that at the time when people's, you know, civil rights are actually the most free in any culture in history – they see this as very dark. So you see all the stuff on college campuses. Then on the right, you've got this impulse where the right feels, particularly a lot of young men, feel very isolated. And if they're told that you're bad because you're white or you're male or you're straight, and then they're constantly shamed, you're going to push people into extremes. So this sense where actually what a lot of the right impulse is not a traditional Republican response, it's not a traditional conservative response.
Right.
It's punk rock. Like, it's, right, I'm going to smash the system. Like, what's the most transgressive thing I can do now? Become a neo-fascist.
Right.
You know, don't tell me I can't use that word about women. I'm just going to use it online. So it bubbles up online in the dark places of the internet and then explodes up. And because the left has been in such a bubble, and in cities like mine and yours, I can get in that bubble.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I read the newspaper, which is written all by... there's a commentator in Australia, Mark Latham, who said recently, I'm the last newspaper columnist who actually lives in the suburbs. And all the rest are millennials who live in the inner city, and they're in that bubble, you know.
Yeah.
So this is why everyone gets Trump wrong, all the predictors. This is why everyone got Brexit wrong. Maybe this is what they'll get Le Pen. Everyone's saying, oh, Le Pen's not going to win.
And it's why Portland was so confused in the last election cycle.
Yes.
Because I think even for me, as a follower of Jesus, so I'm not a leftist, but I'm in a leftist city, I think my assumption was just that we will continue to march forward towards Scandinavia. And
yes.
Portland is the paragon of the future. Eventually, all of America will move to the left and will move towards, you know, secularization. But that's not what happened. But what's interesting to me is it seems like we're seeing now secularization on the left and on the right.
Yes.
Not that it wasn't before, but I think it's safe to say, and... You know, I'm sure some people would not like this statement, but that as a general rule in American politics, the left has been more secularized for the last couple of decades than the right. And that's not to say the right was more Christian or whatever, but I think there was more hostility toward the way of Jesus from the left, at least from a political ideology, than from the right. There's a higher comfort level with God and faith and family values and such as that. But I think now we're seeing secularization on the right as well as the left, but it looks very different. Mm. It doesn't look like the LGBTQ agenda or the genderless world or the borderless world. It looks more like I have my gun in my back truck and we're going to close our borders and we're going to do this, that, and the other on marriage number four. And, you know, so it's a fascinating cultural moment now.
Totally.
Would you agree with that or no?
Yes.
We're starting to see secularization, but on the right and on the left.
Well, studying the alt-right heaps, which I did to get my head around it, like I discovered it's very different to what people think. You know, it's not like the alt-right's just stuck its head up. It actually hates the alt-right and is not socially conservative. And it's traditionalist, but it's more around race and Western culture.
Right.
And someone said a comment that they don't like Christianity, but they like Christendom. I thought it was really interesting.
Wow. Oh, my gosh.
And a lot of them into Stoicism, a lot into paganism and European original paganism, which has contours to the original fascist movement, but it's totally postmodern. I mean, what's hilarious is like to hear Kellyanne Conway say the term alternative facts. This week when asked about interfering in the French election, one of the anchors on the Russian propaganda, for want of a better term, Channel Sputnik said, well, there's no objective truth. We're just giving our truth. And then to hear on this right side language which the left on college campuses has been using for years, and then that relativism then thrown back at them. So I think it's like almost a postmodern right is what we've got using the tactics of the left. So someone like Steve Bannon, who's sort of on the outer now in the Trump White House, talks about let's take the tactics of the left and use them against them. So this is why we've seen this increased extremes of left and right. Just sorry, just a quick comment on the Scandinavia thing. Melbourne's the same. Like, you hear all these articles about, there's all these books, Living Danishly and Scandinavia and but no one noticed what was actually happening in Scandinavia. So
it's almost like the Scandinavia of the 90s.
Yes, exactly. So in Scandinavia, you got young entrepreneurs reading Ayn Rand and rebelling against the welfare state. You've got, I heard this about 4 years ago, someone said the future is Swedish politics, where you've got one side of like radical lesbian feminists and the other side of like ex-Nazis, and that's the future. And I heard that at the time, I thought, that's extreme. But now I'm like, it's not so far from the truth.
Yeah.
So that's actually where Scandinavia's gone.
Talk to us about, obviously because in Portland, the alt-right is more something we read about than we experience day to day. Talk to us about the origins of the leftist, hard left vision of society and all that comes with it, gender, sexuality, marriage, family, religion. Talk to us about its origins.
Yeah. So leftism originally begins with an economic vision. And it's an economic vision which, interestingly, has Christian roots. So a lot of the early thinkers, Karl Marx was Jewish and had those prophetic stories. He knew from his sort of Jewish
about social justice.
Social justice, Jubilee. All that sort of Old Testament great stuff. Engels, his co-writer, was inspired by the Salvation Army and was like, what if we could have a secular Salvation Army, which is really interesting. So then...
And the Salvation Army, if you don't know, were kind of some of the first, I don't know if this is the right language, evangelicals that were really serious about social justice, right?
Well, it comes out of the British stream of
evangelicalism. Yeah, William Wilberforce, the British stream of evangelicalism had a much higher value for social justice, where in America it kind of fragmented between liberals who cared about social justice and evangelicals that cared about Orthodox historic faith.
Yeah,
but England always held the two together, hence Wilberforce, Salvation Army.
Just similar to Australia, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so they then... obviously that thought gains steam, and there's an element there of that somewhere in the past there existed this perfect political world where people were held and they had rights, and then culture had come and messed that up. So there were systems which of authority and oppression which had then grown up.
Yeah.
So if we could just blow all that stuff up
so
and get
it's back humanistic to that. At its root.
Yes,
right?
And it's
not
revolutionary.
A high value of what we would call original sin.
Exactly. So it's revolutionary, and you can even trace back to the French Revolution of let's tear down all the stuff and get back to that original perfect place.
So from the beginning, there's a deep suspicion of all power structures, right?
Yes.
The idea is that power is corrupt, power is what's gone wrong in the world,
yes.
And if we can get rid of power and the power structures,
yes.
whether that be a president or a king or a Republican Party, a Democratic Party, then we can usher in our utopia, right?
But there's this really weird, toxic idea, and you can look at this in Rousseau with his idea of the general will, or it's best explained by one of the French revolutionaries called Saint-Just in the city of Strasbourg, and he said, we will force you to be free. So you need freedom, you need liberation, you need equality, and if you don't want it, we're going to use force to get you to want it. So the Republican Army of France, led by Napoleon, then goes on this march through Europe to liberate everyone, but weirdly oppressing them at the same time. So fast-forwarding towards Marx, you obviously then have this economic form of Marxism, which begins with communism.
Yeah. So the point you're making is that it started as an economic vision around things that followers of Jesus, for the most part, would agree with, in particular social justice.
Yes.
But it was rooted in this kind of humanistic view that did not have a high view of original sin, that if we can get rid of the corrupt power structures, tear that down, we'll usher in utopia.
And they would have these various conferences called the Internationalize, and they would have like the first one, the second one, and I can't remember if it was like the third or the fourth. They kick out the Jewish and the Christian members of this movement, and it becomes secular. So
and then, this is what year?
Oh, this is the 19th century.
Got it.
So 1917... Russia, to everyone's surprise, has a revolution. It falls, and then we have communism. And communism spreads to different countries. And what happens is there's still this idea to outlaw marriage. There's still this idea to create or rip down the existing structures.
Part of which is the family.
Yes, part of the family. So it's interesting.
And that's rooted in male hierarchy, and that's the problem.
Totally. Right? And Marx saw marriage is ultimately an oppressive thing that comes from capitalism of ownership and so on. But interestingly, by the 1930s, as they realize that Germany is rearming, as they realize that what this is doing, it's ripping apart their social structure.
It's not working.
It's not working and actually makes your nation weak. And just quick side note, it's interesting what's happening in the West now. So the progressive cities of the West have horribly low fertility. So if you look at Melbourne, and I've looked at the stats, if you look at our inner city gentrified neighborhoods, fertility rate in the negative. You look at the north of Melbourne, where there's lots of Arabic families, high fertility rate.
Right.
Areas in, you know, where there's Sudanese families, traditional Catholics.
And that's an economic problem, right? And
exactly.
I'm not a mathematician, much less an economist, but my understanding is you have to have a positive growth rate
for
the economy just to stay stable, much less
grow. So what that means is the West is then having to have high immigration to then make up for the faulty...
The breakdown of the family.
The breakdown of the family and the highly individualistic lifestyle. So...
And the disconnection of sex from not only marriage but procreation.
Totally. And maybe we can talk about this later, but ultimately the progressive vision destroys sex. I'll come back to that.
Oh, yeah. Let's
get to that. So what happens then is ultimately communism becomes a religion. And it becomes a Christless religion. So it wants the kingdom of God, but it wants it without God.
Yeah.
And so you have Stalin come in. Lenin was already like this, but Stalin comes in and it becomes what Khrushchev would call the cult of personality. So you've got all these Western leftists who are obsessed with the Soviet Union. They would go and visit, and it was this ultimate utopia. But the cracks in that reality start to fall down. And
At what point did the leftist vision move from an economic vision to a full-on social and moral vision about, you know, a genderless society, the redefinition of sexuality, marriage, so on and so forth?
So the key point is 1968, when people expect there to be a revolution in France. The sort of intellectual leftists and students expect that the working class is going to join them in this rebellion, but the working class don't. And they start to complain that the working class have become seduced by consumerism and shopping and television. So therefore, it starts to move away from this attempt to change the economics, and instead it looks to the social structures. Foucault, a thinker, begins to see this idea that that what's actually evil is the Western sort of imperialist culture. They have to, in their head, go, communism ended up turning evil, and they have to create this moral equivalence where the West is just as evil. And that's a hard argument to make because, you know, Stalin's killing millions and millions of people.
Right.
But they say, well, there's this hidden power in the West. And they use this language of micro powers that the entire West is filled with, almost these hidden bits of power that you can't see.
And everything's corrupt.
Everything's corrupt.
We've got to tear it all down. It's like
totally.
It's like the WikiLeaks generation.
Yes.
You know? Everything's corrupt. We got to tear it all down.
Yeah. So you've got Herbert Marcuse who has this idea that that one way that we then can liberate the working man who's seduced by television is to break down social mores. So basically, if he can break down his social rules, people then will just have sex all day and the entire economic system will fail. So it's another way of actually undermining the entire social system. But what ends up happening is, look now, you know, Tinder is the coming together of the economic system and pornography and sex and capitalism. That actually what's happened is that our sex now is reflected by a consumerist mentality. So Marcuse's dream that sexual liberation and sexual freedom would actually liberate people from Western economic systems is actually not true. It's actually just worked hand in hand with creating an even less connected society who then buy more stuff.
Yeah, and that are even more consumeristic and carry that approach over into sexuality. So what's the law? I mean, it seems to me that at the center of the leftist vision is its redefinition of sexuality and marriage. What's the long term? Where does that land? Like, you know what I mean?
I actually think it's not so much. I think sex is part of it, but I think it's the actual ultimate, seeing freedom as humans being absolutely free from any external rules, authority, or definition. So this belief that people only be free when they're free to absolutely define themselves and escape these micro powers. So there's this really weird link between, if you think about it, the Trumpian, Le Pen, UKIP, Orban vision of close the borders, let's have our perfect nationalist homeland where there's this purified space where we get the evil outside, to almost the safe space movement in colleges of let's keep the bigots out, let's keep the racists out. You know, there was a report that I can't remember where it was, but some student somewhere has argued that, you know, their college shouldn't have a Chico Phil because of their record as, you know, so like that's affecting them. They want it out of that college. So weirdly, that's another border. That's another purification of the land.
Ideological border.
Ideological
border. Which is the interesting about the left. We want people of every ethnicity and every gender and every form of sexuality who all think exactly like us.
Exactly.
Yeah, zero ideological diversity.
So I think phase two of progressivism, and it's really interesting. So Le Pen, right, people go, oh, she's like Trump. She's actually quite economically to the left. She's almost a socialist. Her argument is we need to keep out migrants, and particularly Muslim migrants, so that gay people can be protected. Geert Wilders, who people thought would do well in the Dutch elections, that's his total language. We need to keep Holland the most tolerant progressive culture in the world, so therefore Muslims and religious conservatives cannot come here. So how that sort of plays out is like if Portland was like it is and then took in a huge refugee intake and then you had lots of Islamic people
with a conservative view,
with a conservative worldview, or
gender,
African
marriage,
Pentecostals or whatever.
Right.
And then all of a sudden people start to realize, hang on, they're putting out their own candidates and there's parts of town where I'm not comfortable two girlfriends holding hands. In Holland, I think it was 2 weeks ago, there was this whole campaign of straight men holding hands in solidarity of this gay couple who were beaten up. They were beaten up by Moroccan immigrants who were Muslim. So what's happening is that then you start to get this view that, hang on, what is endangering progressivism and inclusion and tolerance and diversity is migrants. So that, I think that's where this goes in stage two.
Wow, absolutely fascinating shift. Talk to us before we're done about one of the, I think, the most helpful parts of your book was kind of the religious architecture that you see underneath this now political divide between nationalism and globalization. And you don't have a cat in the game. You don't even make a point at the end of the book, you know, which vision you think is better or whatever, although there's all sorts of implications of followers of Jesus. But talk to us about some of your work around the kind of purity boundary space and the religious nature of the modern political fiasco that we find ourselves in.
Yeah. Well, Peter Lighthart, in his reading of Galatians 4, where Paul talks about, he warns the church in Galatia not to fall back into what he calls the elementary principles of the world. And
it's an odd phrase. I've always read that.
Totally.
What is Paul getting at there?
And what Lightheart did for me is he helped me realize that what he's saying there is that's like the religious and social architecture, that Jews had this system where God had created a temple. There was a system where the temple was pure. There was like where the God-fearers, who were Gentiles, could go up to. There was a point where the women could go up to. And then all the way up to the high priest once a year going to the holiest of holies. So there's this system of borders and lines and purity. Lightheart puts out that pagan religions have that as well. They're almost all built around what's purity. So the Romans blamed the Christians when things were going well for the Roman Empire that they had made the Roman Empire impure. Even today in many parts of the world, lots of religions don't eat pork or don't kill a cow. There's this idea of purity. There's also an idea of sacrifice. We must make sacrifices for when there has been impurity. So Marc Auger, who's a French philosopher, has this idea that there is two places now in the modern world in which we live. There's place, which is about almost that idea of the elementary principles, where it's almost like, here's the soil, who's in, who's out, who are you connected to, who's from actually this place. The place is where I find meaning, but I submit my freedom to get meaning. And this is, there's non-places, the airport, the Uniqlo store, which is exactly the same around the world, the hipster coffee shop, where I can have a flat white now on the other side of the world, but the hipster coffee shop, which could be in London, it could be in New Zealand, anywhere. Where it's not about meaning, it's about freedom.
The internet.
You start to lose the internet totally. So you can be who what you want to be. You can redefine yourself, no authority. And that relates to, in chapter 5, Paul talks about the other danger that faces the church is not going back to the old ways of worship now that we have freedom in Christ, but running too far with freedom in Christ, beyond Christ, where do not use the freedom to indulge the flesh. So there's two temptations towards the flesh. One is going back into the elementary principles of the world and worshipping and submitting ourselves again to enslavement, whether that's in a Torah observant sense or whether that's in a secular sense or in a Portland or Melbourne sense or in a Donald Trump, Le Pen vision of nationalism and borders.
So what does that look like in a Portland?
I think in a Portland that is we are a utopia bubble who doesn't want diversity of thoughts to come here. We will throw language of words like inclusion, tolerance. Yeah. We'll put a sign out the front saying we accept all genders, etc., races, blah, 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 and religions, but it's all ideological.
Yeah, as long as you agree with every single thing that we say.
Exactly. So we'll accept someone if they're the good Muslim who thinks like us. We'll accept someone who's the liberal Jew who thinks like us. We'll accept the progressive Christian who thinks like us. But it's actually ultimately intolerant.
Yeah.
So I think that's what it looks like in cities like yours and mine. Oh, well, here's a safe space, guys, and we'll keep the bad stuff in the world outside. And then the other temptation just to run into freedom, absolute autonomy, to try and create utopia on Earth by giving humans more and more freedom, which then leads...
As defined as the right to do whatever the heck you
want.
Right,
exactly. Almost this libertarianness, which will then deliver the kingdom of God.
So, in wrapping up, a couple of questions. One, when you think about Portland or your city or Copenhagen or San Francisco or Seattle or these other kind of progressive bastions around the secular West, what do you envision 20 years from now? What do you see our city like and yours 20 years from now?
I'm definitely seeing my city in... You're seeing a... Melbourne's... Incredibly multicultural.
Which Portland does not share that.
No. So, you know, I think it's like 45% overseas born, and that's not including people who've got parents. And, you know, my neighborhood where I grew up, it'd be, you go to the downtown part, like where the mall is, and it's 98% Chinese. But then downtown, it's this, not downtown, but in the hipster gentrified bit in the north,
kind of
it's overwhelmingly post-Christian, Anglo-Saxon, single people, which is just bizarre in our city. And you've then got this working class social conservatism, which is post-Christian in Australia. You've got a migrant social conservatism. And I think we're going to start to see clashes between those two things. Also, what's happening is I would bet that there's an underground right in Portland that dare not to speak its name.
Yeah.
But a lot of young guys, college students...
That will grow.
That will grow, that are online. They don't talk about it in public. But if you went on some forums, and I've had guys come to our church who basically have gone alt-right and are to the right of me and then come to our church and become more moderate. As a pastor, I've had to realize that I presumed everyone would come from the left. We have to prepare that you're going to talk to Chinese people. You're going to talk to young guys who are 18. David Frum said something really interesting. He said colleges are now producing hardcore conservatives because their young guys are so reacting, and girls are so reacting, like you can't even wear this Halloween costume.
Right.
Girls, you can't dress in that short skirt. So the more you make something taboo, the more transgressive and cool it becomes. So I think we're going to start to encounter this stuff, and I think it's just going to get more contentious.
So more polarization, and not just between right and left, between multiple different factions in society. Yes,
exactly. The way I say it is, like, what we thought it was like up to now was the Cold War, Russia versus the United States. The future's going to look like the war in Syria. 1,000 factions, people swapping sides, an event where you've got people wearing veils, holding hands with, you know, lesbian activists, and the next thing, them turning on each other. One of the weirdest things we're seeing is, like, some of the new atheists, like, almost becoming friends with some of the Christians because they both believe in absolute truth. Like, right. So the weirdest stuff, we're going to see more and more weird stuff and constant changing of sides.
So what do you think, in closing, is the most, if you could say one thing to followers of Jesus at Bridgetown Church in Portland and those listening online and other like similar contexts, what would you say is the most important thing to live into over the next 5, 10, 15 years?
Yeah. I believe, and I'm getting more and more of this sense, that God is doing something. He has put churches like yours and mine in our cities for a reason. I'm seeing a really interesting coming together of biblical orthodoxy, cultural conversantness, but cultural prophecy, like, not like, hey, we're here to be missionaries amongst you and we're going to drink the same beer.
And be cool and relevant.
But actually, this is what's happening, guys, as an apostolic thing, because we have this, we're part of it but not part of it viewpoint. The Spirit's up to something in a new, interesting way. We're looking at our cities again, like, what are the strongholds over Melbourne? What's the strongholds over Portland? Praying into that, speaking into that, understanding that we're placed here for a reason. We're not here to fit in. We're here because we actually are this place. But we're here just as the church in Greco-Roman cities across the first century were there to be this alternate kingdom, which is in the world but not of it. Belonging, but citizens of heaven. So holding this place, which is going to be uncomfortable, realizing in uncomfortability there's a creative tension, and using that creative tension. Really quick to end. The evangelical movement that you mentioned before, particularly out of Britain, that held together social justice, that held together
and
scripture,
the gospel,
and the Spirit, you know, Methodism and Wesley and Wilberforce and William Booth and Catherine Booth and Hannah More, these people
did everything from end slavery in England to start the Great Awakening in America.
Totally. That they woke up to a world where the old parish system didn't work. They were uncomfortable. The 18th century predicted Christianity would die. The 19th century, Auguste Comte predicted it would be dead by the beginning of the 20th century. And it was exactly at the darkest moments that God did something again. Wow. So I don't say just hang on. I don't say retreat. I don't say close the doors and bang out the windows. And I say get ready, because I think God's going to do something.
Yeah, this could be the moment of rebirth and renaissance for the church.
Totally. Man.
Hey, Mark, we're just so grateful for your time this afternoon, sitting down for all of your books. Again, Strange Days is the most recent one. It's a great read. On the question, has the world gone mad? Disappearing Church is our personal favorite, but everything by Mark is fantastic. People want to listen to your teaching, podcast you at
redchurch.org.au.
I do. I just, my last run, I was listening to your Easter teaching, which was similar to mine, just much better. You know. but we're so grateful for you. I can't wait to be with you in California in the next couple of days. Thank you for your time.
Oh, thank
you. A ton of love to you.
Thank you.
And this is the Bridgetown Church podcast, signing off.